Thank you for joining AUSA's Army Matters podcast. This special edition podcast focuses on understanding and discussing post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Over 2.7 million U.S. service members, including 1.3 million Army soldiers, have deployed since 2001. Studies and news reports throughout the years have documented a high concern with the long-term impact of PTSD. Various studies have estimated that PTSD occurs in around 15% of veterans who have deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. Studies have also shown that this is comparable to prior wars such as Vietnam and Desert Storm. Furthermore, there are estimates that 8% of all Army soldiers have symptoms meeting criteria for PTSD. It is also important to note that PTSD also occurs after other types of trauma such as sexual assault, accidents, or natural disasters. I am Nzinga Curry, the host of today's podcast, and I am happy to welcome three distinguished guests, Lieutenant General Najah West, who currently serves as the 44th Surgeon General of the United States Army and is Commanding General of the U.S. Army Medical Command, Lieutenant Colonel Dennis Sarmiento, who is the Director of the Behavior Health Team at the Office of the Army Surgeon General, and Dr. Charles Hoge, the psychiatrist and senior scientist at the Office of the Army Surgeon General. Welcome. So let's begin by defining PTSD and helping our listeners understand what PTSD is. Ma'am?
It's really a pleasure to be here and talk about this really important health concern, which may have been referred to as the invisible wounds of this current war. I have with me two members of my staff, the two awesome subject matter experts, as you mentioned, Lieutenant Colonel Sarmiento, who's the chief of our Behavioral Health Division, and then retired Colonel Charles Hoge, who's also probably one of the most well-known experts in post-traumatic stress disorder in the entire country, if not the world. But we'll stay with the country here for now. And Dr. Hoge has led many of our major research studies that the Army's conducted during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I'll turn it over to my experts here, and I'll let Dr. Hoge give the listeners a really brief description of PTSD. Yeah.
So PTSD is essentially the after a traumatic event or challenging event in combat, for instance, and when the fight or flight response just stays turned on and it doesn't shut off afterwards. So what people experience is hypervigilance. They startle easily. They might have intrusive memories or thoughts or nightmares related to the events that they experience. Those kinds of experiences tend to lead to avoidance of anything that might kindle a memory. Avoiding crowds, avoiding being out, going out to, a shopping mall, for instance, because there are crowds there. It's essentially the fight or flight response staying turned on, and the person stays revved up all the time. It can disturb sleep. It can affect concentration. And memory problems can happen as a result.
So it's understood that most experience stress due to traumatic events, as you spoke of. So we have stress, fear, and other reactions. But when does it evolve into post-traumatic stress disorder? How does one distinguish the difference between PTSD and normal reactions due to stress and trauma?
As Dr. Hoge alluded to, our soldiers are really highly trained to respond to dangerous situations in combat. They have to be, again, alert to ensure that they can complete the mission and also to ensure the safety of their fellow soldiers as well. So that's a very stressful environment that they're in. There are combat stress control personnel that do accompany the units in theater when they deploy. And as was mentioned again, stress reactions are expected and treatment is best administered as far forward as possible. And so I will turn it over to Dr. Hoge to give our listeners some additional information on how we distinguish from those reactions in PTSD.
There's a spectrum of normal response to stress to, response where, it can interfere with functioning in some way. And so it's very common and it's expected in the operational environment that there will be stress reactions, but they're very easily treated, usually far forward on the battlefield. And most everyone recovers from that. And then there's a small percentage of people who go on to develop symptoms that persist or interfere with functioning. And sometimes it's a little bit difficult to, there's not a clear line, not clear demarcation between normal and abnormal. So For instance, oftentimes we see service members who function very well in their unit, but they have some functional impairment problems at home. Their PTSD reactivity has affected their relationships, for instance, at home, but they're still highly functional, you know, in the operational environment. So you can see this, you know, it's not necessarily consistent across one's life. So we look at the level of functioning and the level of symptomatology and how long people have had those reactions in determining who needs treatment.
Okay. So you spoke about the Army determines who needs treatment. So how is the Army working with soldiers who develop PTSD? May it be military combat or sexual assault? What is being done to help our soldiers?
First, I'd like to explain how our Army leadership views this. And so I think it starts at the top, which I'm really proud of the fact that our senior leaders understand that this is an extremely important issue for them to tackle. So they're tackling it from the highest levels in our Army, recognizing that we have to make sure that we take care of our soldiers in this realm. So again, it's leader emphasis from the highest levels is really important. And in Army medicine, we to support that, we recognize that providing care for soldiers is really vital to readiness, because as our chief says, readiness is number one and there is no other number one. Making sure that we're ready in this area is extremely important. And so to meet the challenge, we've really expanded and transformed our system of care. And I'm going to turn it over to Colonel Sarmiento to kind of talk a little bit more about that, our system of care and those things that we've done.
Okay. We've standardized programs to provide the best care regardless of location, regardless of your duty status, your duty location. One such program is the Embedded Behavioral Health Program. Simply, it is a single point of entry for soldiers to enter behavioral health care and deliver that care within the unit footprint. That is culmination of our standardization efforts. It's intended to be unit aligned. So we support not just the soldiers that are seeking care and promoting help-seeking behavior. We're also supporting the leaders and helping make decisions related to readiness. In that context, we provide evidence-based treatment within the footprint and even within units that don't have an embedded behavioral health team. The key concept is aligning medical assets, behavioral health assets, to that unit so that there is a culturally competent aspect that is rendered consistently. Simply, they know what the unit's going through. They understand what the soldiers are experiencing. They have insight and can share that with the leadership in a timely fashion, which enables them to communicate effectively and address some of the, not just PTSD, but all aspects of behavioral health care. One other program that I'll highlight is a program that is now considered a DoD standard with respect to monitoring and measuring how well do our patients respond to treatment. And that's something called the Behavioral Health Data Portal. Briefly, the Behavioral Health Data Portal is a web-based application started by the Army, but now adopted by the Navy and the Air Force. And it helps us assess essentially your vital signs. It's standardized instruments that we administer at every appointment within behavioral health care, and it helps us track your response, the soldier's response to treatment, and helps us refine in a real-time fashion what we can do to better improve those clinical outcomes. So in the end, with standardized programs to address soldiers wherever they are and a means to measure the benefit that they receive, we're able to provide precision medicine and support readiness efforts.
That's really been recognized not only in the military, but by our civilian partners as a best practice that we've been able to share to improve that nationwide. So that's a really good news story.
So why is it such a stigma associated with PTSD?
I can jump in here. Stigma is pervasive in society at large. Mm-hmm. So this is an issue not just for the military. Right. And it's also well known that stigma is greater in men than in women. And the Army is a large proportion of the military is men and who are really reluctant to seek care to begin with. So we come in with that as a baseline. And then we're working in an occupational setting where there's fears that any perception of weakness might impact one's career. Yeah. And so stigma has been something that we've been focused on really since the beginning of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. It was something that we recognized early on, the very beginning of the war, that not only would we have a psychological cost of war, but that also service members often would not come in to seek care when they needed care. So things like embedded behavioral health is actually one of the most innovative, you know, changes in structure of care in Army medicine, you know, in maybe several decades, in the sense that for the first time, mental health professionals, you know, were moved out of the MTF clinics that they were used to working in and into satellite clinics throughout the, you know, across the Army, close to where soldiers worked. So that was one of the first steps. And then there was a number of other things that were done to reduce stigma, including increases in screening programs, deployment screening programs, or periodic health assessment programs, or when folks come into primary care, they get screened for mental health concerns when they come into primary care as well. And so a number of efforts have been, you know, we still always have a ways to go with stigma. It's not, you know, we've seen improvements, but there's always gaps, and there's always a certain percentage of individuals who need care or don't get care. And we're always trying to think of innovative ways to reach out to those individuals.
A recent input I would say is the Secretary of the Army has signed an Army directive, which has supported the promotion of voluntary care for alcohol-related behavior. So oftentimes we know that alcohol use can fluctuate given the stressors that a service member, even family members, may experience. But one of the stigma reinforcing aspects of that is if you're involved in alcohol-related care, you potentially could be separated from service. So there's an administrative disposition that could prevent folks from seeking care because they know that their career, their livelihood is at risk. So the Voluntary Care Directive was in place to promote help seeking, that there was no mandatory enrollment for specific indications, so that soldiers can come in if they self-report and seek help at a time before there's an actual duty limitation imposed, where there's no functional impairment that has been manifested.
You know, and to kind of stress what Dr. Hogan and Colonel Sarmiento mentioned, it's all about leadership. Again, it goes back to leadership. So all those great initiatives, we have a phrase in the military, so well, that briefs well, but how is it operationalized? How is it actually implemented? And it's all about, we can tell individuals, tell soldiers, this won't affect your career, or there's no problem getting help. But unless it's modeled by our senior leaders, then it's not, you know, there's still skepticism. So our senior leaders have been really great about not only modeling it themselves. We've had some senior leaders who've said, hey, I had issues and I got help. And so they were actually very public with their challenges. So they could show, hey, my career was not harmed by getting the help that I need. And so, as Dr. Hogue mentioned and Colonel Sarmiento, the embedded behavioral health, that's been embraced by our senior leaders. In fact, when they were first rolling them out, those that didn't have them yet were really clamoring to get that asset and that capability in their units because they saw the positive effect. And so that also goes a long way in allowing soldiers to understand, yes, I can get help for myself or my family, and it won't impact my career adversely. So again, as mentioned, long way to go, but I think it's leadership from the top that models that behavior and actually encourages our soldiers and family members getting help that makes a difference as well.
So you spoke about screening, but how does one know if they have PTSD before they actually go in to get help? How do I know, okay, I'm showing signs this leads to PTSD? Is self-diagnosis a problem? Is that welcome? Or should the person just automatically go in and seek help?
Yeah, you know, information is key, isn't it? It's really important for individuals to understand and know the signs and symptoms of mental health, not only for themselves, but you know, we're all about teams in the Army. And so we can recognize it in ourselves or recognizing in one of our colleagues that may be hurting.
Okay. So what else has been learned over the years as far as how Army is conducting research to have a better understanding of PTSD?
Well, Ms. Craig, I can tell you, since September 11th, the Army has really taken a proactive approach and made a considerable investment in understanding the impact of this war and also acting on this information, because you can study it, but it's acting on it that really will get you places. So the Army's been a leader in some of the highest visibility research in PTSD, suicide, and other behavioral health concerns. And we've actually had teams of Army researchers from the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research deployed repeatedly to Iraq and Afghanistan to conduct research as part of these mental health advisory teams, and published in their findings in some of the leading medical journals to share that information and their findings. And also the Army's Medical Research and Materiel Command has managed a PTSD research portfolio of over $200 million since 2010. And that includes many clinical trials that have informed some clinical practices and have, you know, given some, you know, modalities that my team members here today are talking about. And so I'll turn it over to Dr. Hoag, if you could give us some highlights on some of those research.
Sure. You mentioned many of them. The maybe some of the key ones that stand out to me was very early in the war, we published on the prevalence, and the headlines that got picked up, you know, was something around 1 in 6 soldiers develop PTSD or depression after combat. That was the headline. But the sub-headline was really the most important finding, which was that only 20% of soldiers had received any care or were willing to go in for help. And so that became really our call to action to start down the road of what could we do to resolve the stigma concerns. And so there's been a number of studies since then looking at stigma and then looking at programs to impact that. The other highlights, the Medical Research and Materiel Command portfolio that General West mentioned includes a number of clinical trials, and those clinical trials have come to fruition now over the last decade and have informed our clinical practice guidelines. So the VA and DoD have a clinical practice guideline that guides the clinical care, but it also is a model guideline that's used internationally and referred to, referenced internationally.
So you spoke about, you know, again, stigma, and then we also spoke about soldiers wanting or being willing to get care or seek care. So how do we encourage our soldiers to focus on strengthening their mental health, much like we encourage them to focus on strengthening their physical health? How do we make sure that soldiers are seeking the help that they need?
You know, many of the studies have shown that the same things that impact our physical health also enhance our mental health. You know, we have something called a performance triad that was started by my predecessor, a very elegant but simple, you know, sleep, nutrition, activity. Those three major things, if you get the appropriate levels of sleep, you know, make sure that your activity levels, you know, are commensurate with what your, you know, what your body can handle, your age and what you're able to do. And then good sleep, good nutrition, because that's, you know, fueling yourself and the proper foods really make a difference. And so there are many options for soldiers and family members to get the help they need and get education. We have wellness centers to assist them with, you know, understanding what they, you know, proper diet for their body habitus, applications that can help them with menus and sleep and activity monitors to make sure that they're getting the proper amounts of that. And they can also start by discussing their concerns with their primary care physician. As Colonel Sarmiento mentioned, there are many entry points, but starting with the basics, just talk to your doctor or your physician's assistant or whoever your primary care manager is about some of these issues. We also are starting the initiative of having other providers types down in the units, similar to the embedded behavioral health, dietitians, physical therapists, trainers, athletic trainers, to get after some of those modalities, those dimensions I mentioned with the nutrition and the activity. And also at every behavioral health clinic in the Army, soldiers can walk in and ask to see someone. And so we try to make sure that the access to care, access to information is as easy as possible, so we can encourage individuals and don't have barriers that will encourage that stigma of, well, hey, I can't get in for that. And Dennis, I don't know if there's anything else you want to add on that.
I think you hit on it perfectly. I think the key part is what you said in regards to eliminating, if not reducing, obstacles to care. And so I want to reassure those that are listening to this conversation that the Army Behavioral Health System of Care provides a span of care from the least restrictive to the most restrictive, from the outpatient setting to the inpatient setting. This is a capability that's been developed over the last decade or so, and really more formalized within the last 5 to 6 years. It serves as a model for the military health system. And I want to reassure the folks that are listening that we are here to support you, that no one is alone. And so whether it's through embedded behavioral health, your multidisciplinary behavioral health clinics, whether if it's seeing your internal behavioral health consultant in the primary care medical home or the Army medical home, we're there to support you at the front line, whether that's close to your unit headquarters or back in the footprint of the MTF or the clinic. For more intensive treatment, there are options to include intensive outpatient programs. There are many of the installations that we support. There are inpatient facilities and residential facilities for those that need acute care, and also to manage safety concerns when there are truly duty-limiting conditions that have an imminent impact on the mission. So that's suicidality. So we take care of all comers, whether it's coming in to help answer that question. Do I have PTSD? Am I suffering from acute stress? What are the stressors I'm facing right now? How can I better manage them? To the point where, in more severe cases, how do I keep the service member, family member safe? Reassure, again, the listeners out there that our system of care has been developed with this in mind. We are unit-aligned, culturally competent, and our patient-focused and patient-centered approach. And our research informs our approach, not just traditional bench research, but empirical research in terms of developing what should we look like next year or the year after next. So, again, I appreciate the opportunity to engage the audience with this very important dialogue that I think today we're starting. This is intended to help start the conversation, and I encourage folks that are listening to continue and engage the conversation with your leaders, with your peers, and with your healthcare providers.
That was very good information. I thank you all for educating our listeners about PTSD, for distinguishing the differences between PTSD and normal reactions due to stress or trauma, and for discussing how the United States Army is helping in dealing with this issue. Thank you for your time and your information.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Keep it locked here for all Army Matters and for next week's Soldier Today episode. AUSA is the Army's professional association, providing a voice for the Army and support for its soldiers. For more information about AUSA or to become a member, visit AUSA.org.